It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll continue our look at alcohol in Wisconsin. Today, we'll talk about the human toll of drunk driving here in the state and efforts to stop it. First, imagine this. You want some pancakes? The recipe calls for buttermilk. You go to the store, you buy a quart, and let's be honest, you use at most half the container. Then it hangs out in your fridge for a few weeks before you throw the rest away. Well, on Central Time, there's no judgments. Plenty of people have been flummoxed by the fermented dairy product and how to use it outside of the occasional pancake. And if you're really wild, a batch of biscuits. But fear not, our next guest is here to talk about buttermilk and share recipes that use the ingredient in new and fun ways on this edition of Food Friday. Molly Boz is the Senior Associate Food Editor at Bon Appetit. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, Molly, I am not a buttermilk convert. I've probably made buttermilk pancakes maybe twice in my life in the midst of a lot of other cooking. Can you sell me on buttermilk?
Sure. So the reason that I think buttermilk is such an amazing ingredient is because not only does it provide creaminess and fat to whatever you're putting it in, but it also provides tang at the same time. And there are a few other ingredients out there that actually do the same thing. Sour cream acts in a similar way, but is a bit thicker. But buttermilk is incredible because it has magical powers in baking, but it's also very dynamic in savory cooking. So a lot of the recipes that I've used it in and that are on Bon Appetit website actually use it in savory applications.
And before we get into some of those recipes, what exactly is buttermilk?
So historically, buttermilk was the byproduct that was created, that's left over when you churn butter out of cream. And so that liquid that's expelled once the butter comes together was buttermilk. These days, the buttermilk that you'll find in a grocery store is actually just acidulated milk. So that basically just means some sort of acid is added to milk, which curdles it and turns it into buttermilk. Which is also why, in a pinch, if you are making a recipe, let's say for buttermilk pancakes, realize that you're out of buttermilk or you forgot to pick it up, you can acidulate your own milk with a little bit of lemon juice. So in short, the buttermilk that you're likely to find today is just acidulated milk.
And we've added the word acidulate to our repertoire. That's great. I'm glad to have that. Now, what is it about that tang and that, a little bit curdled action that makes buttermilk good in baked goods? What does that do then in the process?
So there's two ways that it works. One of the ways, and the reason that it traditionally is used in baking, is that before baking powder was even in existence, we only had baking soda. And baking soda only activates in the presence of something acidic. So you needed something like buttermilk or sour cream in a baked good in order for the baked good to rise and create lift. And then baking powder was created, which away the necessity for buttermilk, but there's another thing that it does, which is that it helps through its acidity to break down some of the tough strands of gluten that are likely to form in a baked good. So in its absence, that baked good would actually be less tender.
And can I just freely substitute buttermilk for milk in recipes, or do I have to watch out for what else is in the recipe before I make that call?
You would want to watch out because, again, milk is not activated by baking soda. It would be activated in the presence of baking powder. So you'd want to adjust your ratios of baking powder and baking soda according to what swaps you're making. So I wouldn't just go freely substituting it when it comes to baked goods. On the other hand, if you are using it in something like a salad dressing or a cream sauce or as a brine for chicken, you could substitute milk for it, and especially milk that's been acidulated.
We're talking to Molly Boz from Bon Appetit. It is Food Friday, and we're cooking today with buttermilk. We have some links on the Ideas Network Facebook page to some Bon Appetit recipes involving buttermilk. And Molly, let's talk about one of those. This is a classic, I guess, the buttermilk biscuit, and Bon Appetit has this recipe, Bon Appetit's best buttermilk biscuits. So what makes this one so good?
Well, the buttermilk in this recipe acts in the way that I spoke to earlier, which is creating that lift and that rise with the quarter teaspoon. There's a quarter teaspoon of baking soda in this recipe. And then beyond that, what makes this recipe so amazing is actually the process by which you stack the pieces of dough on top of each other and then press down on them, which creates this insane amount of layers in the biscuit. So highly recommend you go make this recipe. It's one of our greats.
And is there a way that people often go wrong when they're making buttermilk biscuits?
I think overworking a biscuit is the worst thing you can do to it. So it takes a little bit of practice to know when your biscuit is, when the dough has been kneaded just enough and not too much. But you're basically looking for, once the buttermilk has been added, the gluten starts to activate. And so once the liquid and the dry ingredients combine, you need to be careful not to overwork the dough. You're looking for a shaggy dough that can be partitioned out into several squares and then stacked up on one another and pushed down to create a very compact biscuit that puffs up in layers in the oven.
I've heard similar things with pancakes. If you overstir it, you stir it too long, it kind of ruins the whole thing.
Sure, it's the same thing. Any baked good will work the same way. Basically, the enemy of a baked good is toughness, and toughness is created through overworking the gluten, which comes from the flour. So the more you overwork a batter, or the more you overknead your dough for your biscuits, the more gluten is formed, which is why buttermilk is such a necessary ingredient, because it helps halt some of that from forming.
All right, that's a pretty straight-up buttermilk recipe. Let's throw in a curveball here now. A recipe I understand you developed for Bon Appetit using buttermilk. You can help me on the pronunciation here. Orecchiette?
It's orecchiette with buttermilk, peas, and pistachios.
I had those last words down. Orecchiette. Okay, talk about this. This is pasta, buttermilk, peas, and pistachios. This is quite a combo. How did you come up with this?
Yeah, so the inspiration behind this was just my love of like a creamy pasta that's made with heavy cream and peas and a little bit of Parmesan cheese. And in the springtime, I thought it would be nicer to have something a little bit lighter and tangier than to have a heavy cream-based sauce. So instead of bringing cream up to a boil in a pot, adding my peas to that and my cooked pasta to it, and then starting to stir in grated cheese, I used buttermilk instead there. So you sometimes will see in pasta recipes that they ask for you to use a little bit of the pasta cooking liquid along with some fat, some butter, or some cheese to create a really nice creamy thick sauce. And in the case of this recipe, you use buttermilk as that base.
That one sounds pretty good to me. And have you improvised on other pasta dishes now with that buttermilk-based sauce?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really specific kind of spring dish, which is actually great for this time of year. But at its very core, you could make something like a cacio e pepe or an Alfredo-type sauce. Just subbing out the buttermilk for the other kind of dairy that might be in it, like heavy cream or milk.
Oh, I like the sound of that because I like Alfredo sauce, and then sometimes I feel logy afterwards because it's such heavy-duty sauce. This will lighten it up for me.
Totally. The one thing you have to keep in mind when you're working with buttermilk at high heat like this is that buttermilk can have the tendency to break if it gets too hot. So you never want to actually boil the buttermilk. You want it to just gently warm up with the hot pasta, and you're never actually going to bring it to a boil so it doesn't break.
We're talking to Molly Baz on this week's edition of Food Friday. She's Senior Associate Food Editor at Bon Appetit. We're talking about buttermilk, how to use it, where to use it, what it is. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a buttermilk believer? What do you do with it? How do you use up that half a quart that you didn't use on the pancakes? Do you use it as a marinade? Do you make your own dressing with it? What kind of recipes do you use buttermilk in? Or do you have a question about what to do with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and find a handful of recipes linked there that our guest has shared with us. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our Food Friday conversation about buttermilk. Molly Baz is with us, Senior Associate Food Editor at Bon Appetit. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And I'll tell you, I don't really do much with buttermilk. I was a little skeptical. I said to our producers, nobody out there is going to get excited about buttermilk. They don't do much with it. You could prove me wrong. Call in at 800-642-1234. What do you use buttermilk for in your cooking, in your baking? Do you have suggestions for other listeners on the best way to maybe use up that spare buttermilk they have left over? Or do you have a question for a guest about what to do with it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Molly, we had an email from Grant who says, my favorite use of buttermilk is to use it in baking yeasted barley bread. He says, I used 50% buttermilk, 50% water. It's delicious. Baking bread with buttermilk. I don't think I've ever heard of that. Have you?
I haven't. I've seen it in quick breads, so things like olive oil cakes and carrot cake loaves and things like that. But this sounds more like a savory bread.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd be interested in trying that. Yeah, it actually sounds pretty good. Now, you mentioned carrot cake. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Molly.
Well, I was just going to say it sounds to me like it might provide some of that tang that we associate with sourdough without having to actually have a sourdough starter.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. Yeah. Now, you mentioned a carrot cake, and you happen to have shared Bon Appetit's best carrot cake recipe with us. We've got that linked at the Ideas Network Facebook page. What does buttermilk bring to the party there?
So there's a lot of fat in a carrot cake and in any cake. And so beyond what we discussed earlier, where the buttermilk is working to tenderize the baked good, it's also providing a little bit of tang, which is balancing all of that fat and sugar that's in the cake and therefore making all of the flavors come out a lot more.
Interesting. So that little, and you know, I think about that when I use acid in a lot of cooking, if I add, you know, vinegar to soup or whatever, that little bit of acid does bring out flavors in a lot of savory dishes. So it sounds like you're saying buttermilk is accomplishing part of the same task.
Totally. If you think about it, like the way you create a salad dressing where you're adding some acid to olive oil, which is your fat, and therefore both things end up tasting better because they're complementing one another. You can use acid in cooking in that way in many things and also in baking.
Well, I want to go to our callers. Looks like they've rallied in defense of Central Time producers here. We have full phone lines. Rosie is with us in La Crosse. Rosie, hi.
I just made a recipe this week that was from New York Times. Francis Lamb, who does The Splendid Table, came up with the recipe, I guess. And it's a roasted broccoli and roasted a mushroom grain bowl with basically a ranch dressing, which is, you know, uses buttermilk and mayo and herb and fresh herbs.
And you used it. How is it, Rosie?
It was wonderful.
And are you stuck with half a quart of buttermilk in your fridge?
I was stuck with two. I split it up into two half pints, and exactly that. And I put one in the freezer, and I don't know how that will work, but hey, we'll see. And the other one, it said that it would hold for maybe 2 or 3 days, and so a couple of days later, I still had enough ingredients left to make another batch, and we did that.
Sounds great, Rosie.
Deja vu all over again, and it was wonderful again.
Sounds great, Rosie. Thank you so much for that. Yeah, that's a good, easy, straight-up use for buttermilk, making your own ranch dressing, Molly.
Totally. Or a Green Goddess dressing could work, too. Or you could use it in a blue cheese dressing. So anywhere that you would otherwise find mayonnaise or sour cream, you could cut it with a little bit of buttermilk for some extra tang.
Thanks for that call, Rosie. And Molly, I don't usually freeze liquid dairy products. Any thoughts on how that's going to come out for her?
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it, although I can't say from experience that I've done it. I think in the thawing process, though, it could get a little bit funky.
All right. Good luck with that, Rosie. We'll go now to Glenn in Milwaukee. Glenn, hi.
Hi. I bought powdered buttermilk just because I didn't want to have the buttermilk sitting around, and I used it to make dressing and a couple other things, and I wanted to find out if the rules change, if you're trying to do the things that were discussed here with the powdered milk, buttermilk. Yeah, it's powdered and you add water and it worked great for the dressing.
So you use it for dressing, but have you tried baking with it, Glenn?
No, I'm not a big baker,
okay.
But I wanted to just find out if the properties change or if the rules are that were discussed here are the same.
Interesting. Molly, powdered buttermilk, have you taken a shot at that?
Yeah, I would say it's actually a really great product based on the fact that it's shelf stable, so no need to worry about what you're going to do with the rest of it. And it does work both in baking and in savory applications once you rehydrate it with either water or milk. So If you want something with a little bit more fat, you'll add milk to it. If you want something leaner, you'll add water. But then beyond that, it'll work the same way in baking.
And it seems like it'd be great for that when you want to marinate meat in it or whatever. It seems like that would be just fine, too.
Totally.
All right, Glenn, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Lisa joins us now in Marsden. Lisa, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what'd you want to ask about, Lisa?
Can you really make buttermilk by adding vinegar to regular milk?
You touched on that a little bit earlier, Molly. We really can acidulate, was that the word, our milk into buttermilk?
Yeah, you totally can. It's not going to have the same flavor as a classic buttermilk would that was made from churned buttermilk that had been soured. But in a pinch, it will 100% work in baking. And even in salad dressings, because if you consider the fact that you're probably adding lemon juice or some kind of vinegar to a salad dressing anyway, it's not the worst idea to just add it to a little bit of milk in a pinch.
Fantastic. All right. Hope that helps you out, Lisa. We're talking about cooking with buttermilk and baking with it on this edition of Food Friday. Molly Boz is Senior Associate Food Editor at Bon Appetit. We'll go back to your calls now. Donna is with us in Greenfield. Donna, hi.
Hi. I wanted to say, lately I've been seeing buttermilk pies in the store, and I tried one, and it was really, really good.
Uh-huh. And so the buttermilk's in the crust, Donna? Is that what's going on there?
No, it's kind of like a pumpkin pie, but it's buttermilk pie.
Oh, so like buttermilk is part of the pie filling, it sounds like, Molly. That I don't think I've ever encountered.
Yeah, so you might have encountered this under the name chess pie.
Okay.
Which I think is a southern pie, but it's basically a custard with eggs, butter, sugar, and buttermilk. So it's baked into something not unlike a lemon curd or something like that.
Or like a sweet quiche almost. It sounds like you're making a custard and baking it, but it ends up being a sweet dish.
Exactly.
And did I see somewhere somebody talked about actually using buttermilk for quiche? What do you think about that?
I think it's a good idea as long as there's some other fat present as well. Quiche to really have a lovely custardy texture, there needs to be a lot of fat in there. And so buttermilk tends to be pretty lean. So I would recommend adding a little bit of sour cream or some heavy cream or even creme fraiche if you're also going to use buttermilk, just because it doesn't have that same sort of unctuous, fatty nature.
Wow, you just solved another problem with me. I'm thinking back of the times I've made quiches with skim milk only, and it was okay, but it wasn't great.
Yeah,
that's going to solve my problem.
Something to be desired.
Awesome. All right. Hey, we're solving a lot of problems today. We'll go back to our callers. Ryan is on the line in Hillsboro. Ryan, hi.
Hi. I tried just this morning making a multi-grain savory yeast bread and added some buttermilk powder to it, and that turned out really good. But what I really wanted to tell you was that I also use fresh buttermilk to make a chowder, a fish potato corn chowder.
Ooh.
And it really works nicely. I make it a little bit spicy with some basil and garlic and olive oil and stuff like that.
That sounds fantastic, Ryan. Thanks for sharing that with us. And Molly, that reminds me, we've got one more recipe you shared with us, speaking of seafood, pan-seared scallops with chorizo and corn. Talk about what goes into this dish and how it comes together.
So I'm happy that he brought that up, because actually the base of that dish that you're referring to is not unlike a chowder. It starts with chorizo instead of bacon, but then there's garlic and onions and some chilies. And then you add corn to it and sort of sweat it down into this corn ragu. And to that, you add buttermilk. So in the way that you might add heavy cream or milk to a chowder, I've chosen to add buttermilk there to keep the dish a little bit lighter and allow the scallops to shine.
All right. We've got that linked again at the Ideas Network Facebook page. Time for at least one more caller. Rachel is with us in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. I just wanted to say that thank you for opening my mind to all this buttermilk stuff, because I do, I help with educational activities for children during the early 1800s fur era stuff, and we teach children how to churn butter. So we have an excessive amount of buttermilk each Memorial Day. So we'll probably be using at least a gallon of buttermilk to make pancakes next weekend.
That's
so
coming
thank
up,
you for
yeah.
You know about that. Yeah.
So you've got the old-fashioned buttermilk, and you don't know what to do. That is fantastic, Molly. Have you ever churned butter yourself?
I have not, actually.
Me neither. But
sometimes.
In your understanding, I have no understanding of buttermilk at all. In your understanding, if we were actually using that stuff out of Rachel's butter churn, would we notice a difference between that buttermilk and the stuff we get in stores?
I think so, because back to what I was saying earlier about how buttermilk historically, when it's made from the byproduct of butter, is a very different product from that acidulated milk. So we're adding that sourness and that acid to it after the fact in the products that we get here. So I think that the sour factor might be a little bit different, and it totally depends on the type of dairy they're using. So I think it's probably a really incredible product, and I am excited for them to try to make pancakes with it.
Rachel, that's awesome. Glad we gave you some uses for all that buttermilk you're making, you know, just anyway. Molly, as we wrap up, any great uses of buttermilk that we haven't gotten to yet in our last minute or so?
I think the only thing we haven't touched on is how awesome buttermilk is when combined with meat as a marinade. So not only is it providing tang, but it is, through its acidity, tenderizing the meat. So a piece of meat that is brined in buttermilk versus a piece of meat that is brined in milk, like a piece of chicken, which then gets fried, the buttermilk brined chicken will taste so much more tender and fall aparty than the one that wasn't brined in it. It's a truly magical thing. So I think if you're left with some buttermilk and you're up to some deep frying, fried chicken in a buttermilk brine is one of the best ways to use it.
That's a great place to leave it. Molly, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Molly Boz, Senior Associate Food Editor at Bon Appetit. She joined us on this week's edition of Food Friday to talk about cooking with buttermilk. You can find links to 4 of Molly's buttermilk recipes that she shared with us over at the WPR.org/Food Friday. Again, WPR.org/Food Friday for buttermilk recipes and recipes from past editions of Food Friday along the way. On the afternoon of January 25, 2002, Kathy Chaflinski drove down I-43 in Ozaukee County with her 2 children. An encounter with a drunk driver would change Chaflinski's life forever. As part of our series High Tolerance, Phoebe Petrovic reports on one family bearing the greatest cost of excessive drinking.
That morning, Kathy Chaflinski had taken her son Jake to his 5-year checkup, and she held him in her arms when it came time for the shots. That afternoon, Chaflinski drove down the highway, her 5-month-old Lauren dozing, Jake counting trucks.
He goes, "Mom, I think I want to take a snooze. Do you mind if I take a snooze?"
Chaflinski said, "Of course not," and Jake nodded off.
In my head, he was asleep. And that's important to me because he couldn't see what was coming.
Chaflinski saw a car coming toward her. It was in the median, then it was in her lane.
Do I stop? Do I play chicken? What do I do?
She turned into the ditch, but the car swerved back into the median, and it T-boned Chaflinski's car. The driver, Wallace Stenzel, had had 2 martinis that afternoon. His blood alcohol was 0.10, just over the legal limit. Chaflinski rode in the ambulance with Lauren. At the hospital, she found Jake lying on a table, wearing 1 shoe, his hand ice cold. The doctor told her Jake died instantly. When Chaflinski's husband Bill arrived, she didn't know what to say.
I felt helpless. I looked at him and I said, he didn't suffer.
Doctors decided to transfer Lauren to the Children's Hospital. Bill stayed with Jake, and Kathy went with Lauren in the helicopter.
And so as we're flying over the city, all I could think of is Jake would love to be in this helicopter for the right reasons.
When they landed, Lauren was rushed in for another procedure. But eventually doctors said it wasn't working. They asked Chaflinski if she wanted to be with Lauren while she died.
And all you could hear was the machines, the beep, beep, beep. You know, no one was saying a word.
A nurse stepped out of the crowd.
She said, "You know, it's okay. You know, come on up. She can hear you. Talk to her." And I did. And I always would rub her little head. And then I, you know, was holding her hand and rubbing her head. And I said, "It's okay, Lauren. I'm sorry I couldn't save you. Go home and be with your brother." And then she passed.
The beeping stopped. Chaflinski says Lauren looked like a porcelain doll.
I'm holding my little baby daughter, and she's dead. She felt like 100 pounds. And then my husband showed up, and he's looking at me, and I'm like, "Do you want to hold her?" And of course he cried and sat down and held her and rocked her.
The driver who killed Shiflinski's children, Wallace Stenzel, spent 8 years in prison. Sometimes Shiflinski has to remind herself that her children died 17 years ago.
To me, it was like yesterday, and it's endless.
Shiflinski says she and her husband have struggled with depression and suicidal thoughts, but she also says they made a choice to figure out how to keep living. They had more children, twins named Tommy and Andrea. Shiflinski sought therapy, took antidepressants, and went to church.
I believe I'm going to see them again, and they're with their Heavenly Father, and I pray for peace and understanding and guidance. And I don't know if I didn't have that, how I would be able to go on to the next date.
Shiflinski grew up in Wisconsin. She says she comes from a family of alcoholics, that her father drank himself to death, that her brother served several years in prison for drunk driving after Jake and Lauren died.
The night of the crash, my dad and my brother were drunk in my basement, and I'm sure one of them, if not both of them, drove home.
Addiction is widely recognized as a disease, but Wisconsin's drinking culture is potent. City groundbreakings and baby showers serve kegs. Wisconsin is the only state that classifies first-time drunk driving as a civil offense. Shiflinski refuses to call her collision an accident. She says it was entirely preventable.
How do you kill these cute little kids? I know you didn't mean to. But again, you had two drinks and they cost them their lives.
Jake and Lauren were just two of 292 people killed in alcohol-related crashes in Wisconsin in 2002. More than 4,000 people have died since. Phoebe Petrovic, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about this story and see the rest of our series, High Tolerance, at WPR.org/alcohol. We're going to talk more now about the human toll of drunk driving with Frank Harris. He's the director of state government affairs with Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Frank, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
Well, Frank, we heard the Shiflinski's story there. I'm imagining that this is the kind of story you hear a lot at MAD.
Yeah, and coincidentally, I actually worked with Bill Shiflinski during the summer of 2001 through 2003 at Grant Park Golf Course in South Milwaukee. And when I read that story, I put two and two together and remembered, just seeing him just even months after that crash, what he was still going through. And I've been with Matt for 11 and a half years. And you see victim after victim going through this 100% preventable crime, violent crime.
Can you talk about the pain felt by families affected by these drunk driving fatalities?
Well, I can't personally because I'm not a victim, but I mean, it upends the world. Just one moment someone's there, the next moment they're not, or one moment someone's there perfectly healthy, the next moment they're injured, horrifically injured. And
In my reading of our further coverage of these issues, I know some people who have lost family members to drunk driving go on to give presentations and talk to people who have been arrested for drunk driving. Do you see that as an effective, hopefully, deterrent for people who are brought in for that first offense?
Well, I mean, I think it's effective to do. There's been some studies on those sort of things called victim impact panels there is some effectiveness to it helping to prevent repeat offenses. And at this point, lawmakers need to enact data-driven approaches that are proven to reduce drunk driving fatalities and more importantly, to deter people from making the deadly choice to drive drunk in the first place.
What do you see as the most effective, as you say, data-driven pieces of legislation that a state could tackle?
Well, I think the biggest data-driven one is ignition interlocks for any convicted drunk driver. And Wisconsin currently, 33 states have laws like this on the books, including Iowa and Illinois. And Wisconsin currently, their ignition interlock law is limited, hasn't been touched since 2009. And it's limited to repeat offenders and those who have a 0.15 blood alcohol level. And we hope lawmakers do something to modernize this program, which has proven life-saving, reducing drunk driving deaths by 16%. And Matt likes ignition interlocks because they're more effective in reducing repeat offenses compared to just hoping for the best and suspending someone's license. And license suspension is a outdated approach that still too many is relied upon too much in this country. And then, another thing is legalizing sobriety checkpoints. I mean, this hasn't even been discussed anywhere in Wisconsin. And then now states are even lowering the legal level to 0.05, Utah specifically. So enacted that, and other states are considering it as well. So there's a lot of things out there that lawmakers can do besides just putting window dressing of the issue of drunk driving. So hopefully lawmakers do something finally. I mean, it's been 10 years since anything truly significant has happened to fine-tune the law, and it's long overdue.
Now, people often point to the fact that Wisconsin is the only state that doesn't criminalize the first-time offense for operating while intoxicated. How important is that?
Well, there's different ways to look at it. So drunk driving is a crime, and it should be treated that way. That's the way Matt feels. Now, the dirty little secret in some of these states that do criminalize it, like a Michigan, for example, pretty much more than 50% of those first OWI offenses are pled down to a lesser offense. It's just commonplace. Same thing with Illinois. Iowa, it's probably not as bad. And in Minnesota, it's definitely, you know, it's still a criminal offense, but there's a lot of plea agreements. So, but still, at least in those states, it's treated as a criminal offense as opposed to just whoopsie doodles. I got blacked out drunk and I drove drunk and didn't kill or injure somebody, but I got arrested. Now I have to have higher insurance rates and I don't even have to go to court. I can just... So you know, it's just drunk driving is a violent crime. I mean, it's killed over 500,000 people in the last 35 years in our country, and more needs to be more action needs to be taken to continue the decrease in this violent crime.
Is a cultural change part of the answer here, as you see it, where just to change attitudes toward the idea of driving after having that couple of drinks in the first place?
Well, maybe, you know, and I grew up on the south side of Milwaukee, and I remember going to the church festival after church festival, Catholic church festivals, and just, you know, remembering all the different beer-related games there at a church festival, for goodness sakes. And living elsewhere in the country, you don't really see that too much, where alcohol is intertwined so much with the culture. But that being said, in order to change the culture, you need to change the laws. And you know, where Matt's at, if people want to drink alcohol and they're 21 and over, that's fine. Consume alcohol. Deal with the other side effects that alcohol might bring. But as long as you don't drink and drive, that's fine and dandy. Just don't get behind the wheel. And that's what we've been trying to preach for the last 39 years, rather. So, you know, there's a cultural change, but, you know, it's not the culture of Wisconsin to lose a loved one to something that's preventable. You know, I can see it being the culture to drink alcohol. That's fine as long as you're 21 and over and you wise up and don't get behind the wheel. Because it's been 39 years that, you know, drunk driving fatalities and injuries has been pretty highly publicized in our country.
Looking nationwide, have you seen states moving in the direction of doing more things like ignition interlocks and some of the other moves you're looking for?
Sure. So 37 states currently legalize the option for sobriety checkpoints. You know, that's sobriety checkpoints is a four-letter word in Wisconsin, especially in the state legislatures. No one wants to touch it. The lawmakers are fine binding the hands of law enforcement in their activities to deter drunk drivers. And if that's the way lawmakers want to handle drunk driving, that's fine. Just there should be more saturation patrols. And now ignition interlocks, that's where we've seen the biggest move in DUI or excuse me, OWI reform in our country. You know, since 2006, Matt's top legislative priority has been pushing for these use of these devices for any apprehended drunk driver. And when we first started pushing for this in 2006, only one state, New Mexico, had a law that essentially mandated the use of these devices for all offenders. And now we're up to 33 states that currently require the devices. And most recently, Kentucky enacted a law in Kentucky, you know, the bourbon state. They're able to enact this and get over the concerns of the alcohol industry. And we still see five or six states that are considering similar legislation. And I think the one bill, I mean, the one issue that is definitely coming up is probably that doesn't have as much public support is lowering the legal level to 0.05. But coincidentally, MAD did come out in support of 0.05 if a state lawmaker wants to consider pushing it in a state. But outside of Utah, no, not too many folks are going to really push that sort of proposal.
We're talking to Frank Harris, Director of State Government Affairs with Mothers Against Drunk Driving, about the human cost of drunk driving, the lives lost and people injured, and families affected by these incidents, and what state lawmakers can do to tackle the problem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see Wisconsin have stricter laws on drunk driving? Should first-time OWIs be criminalized? Have you yourself been affected by a drunk driving accident? And what do you think about the specific recommendations our guest is calling for? Things like, and Matt is calling for things like ignition interlock devices, sobriety checkpoints, maybe lowering the intoxicated rate to 0.05. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about drunk driving and its costs here in Wisconsin. Frank Harris is with us from Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think drunk driving is a problem in your part of the state? If you had driven in the past when you think you probably shouldn't have, what got you to stop driving after drinking? If you're a student, what kind of things have your has your school said about drunk driving? If you're a parent, what do you tell your kids? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Frank, talk a little bit for people not familiar with how these ignition interlock devices work. What are they? What do they do?
So an ignition interlock device is after someone in Wisconsin gets a certain conviction for an OWI, they will be ordered by a court to install this device in their vehicle. Essentially, it's an in-car breathalyzer where if you have any detectable alcohol in your breath, your vehicle won't start. Now, you know, we always say, well, we could have someone else blow into it or you could keep your car idling at the bar parking lot. So an interlock has what's called a rolling retest where within the first 7 minutes after you start your vehicle, you're prompted to blow into the device again. You're given 6 minutes to do this, and you could pull over the side of the road or just do it as you're driving. Then after that, a first initial rolling retest, it's more sporadic, between closer to 20 minutes to even 40 minutes. And again, with interlocks, there's about 13,000 of these in use in Wisconsin currently. And you know, next week, MAD's going to be announcing some pretty interesting data on the number of times this has actually stopped somebody from driving drunk in Wisconsin in 2018. We're going to be announcing this at a conference of ignition interlock program administrators. And we found in 2018 in Wisconsin, interlock stopped 41,000 attempts to drive drunk. In Wisconsin, not the most populous state, obviously, that is the most interlock stops out of the whole country, more so than California, more so than Texas. But Wisconsin's interlock law is very outdated, and it needs to be fine-tuned. And I think Senator Wongkard is going to come up with a proposal to improve it. And there's a couple of proposals out there right now that are out there as well.
Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Door County. Jeff, hi.
Hi, how are you doing? Great topic. I live up in Sister Bay. 2 years ago at Fall Fest, someone was killed driving down the boat ramp drunk. And I understand that they can't have sobriety checkpoints, but there's only one way out of town. And if the police would have cars lined up, and so people knew if you were driving drunk, it would drastically reduce the craziness that goes on up here. I know residents don't even leave their homes during these festivals, the people that live up here, because it's just so crazy.
Jeff, thanks for the call. So he's looking for more law enforcement in areas where there's going to be drinking, even if they can't have sobriety checkpoints, Frank.
Well, yeah, and they can do that right now. I mean, they can have saturation patrols and highly visible saturation patrols. And again, twice yearly, the federal government gives the state of Wisconsin money to do this. And there are law enforcement agencies that are doing this. They seem to be highly visible. Because again, I mean, the goal of a sobriety checkpoint, goal of a saturation patrol is not to arrest anybody. It's to deter people from making the stupid choice to drive drunk.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Going out to Alan in Weston. Alan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Alan?
Well, you know, I'm in and out of the, you know, the alcohol thing, you know, quite a bit because I, you know, drive a tow truck on the weekends and I drive an 18-wheeler during the week. And so I see a lot of different accidents and whatnot with the DUIs and drunk driving accidents. I've towed a lot of them, actually.
And what do you think? Do we need tougher laws?
Yeah, I believe we need stiffer laws. I believe we need, you know, more convictions, harsher convictions. If it's not alcohol-based, if it's drug-based, you're still intoxicated one way or another.
Alan, thanks a lot for the call. So Frank Allen has seen firsthand towing in the aftermath. Do you think people are just distanced from the impact of drunk driving, and that's why maybe we don't have tougher restrictions?
Well, I think society as a whole has been distanced from the impacts of drunk driving since the 1990s. 11,000 people died in 2016 in drunk driving crashes in our country. I mean, that's down 50% since 1980. Drunk driving is one of the top, it's the top leading killer, right around speeding and unbelted. Distracted driving is an issue, but that kills around 3,000 people a year. So, society has definitely been it's not the sexy topic anymore, even in the traffic safety community world, in what needs to be done. But, this is one of the areas where lawmakers can step up and do stuff to fix the loopholes in the drunk driving laws.
Thanks for the call, Alan. We'll go now to Tom with us in Madison. Tom, hi.
How are you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Tom?
Well, I lost a brother in 74 to a drunk driver. He was home on leave from the Marine Corps because his wife had given him his first son, a son that he never got to know.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Tom.
Well, I'm one of 10, and that was the youngest, and that just about killed my mom. He was just 18. But as far as the laws, they can't be strict enough. They have no idea how that'll tear a family apart, because they're selfish and stupid to get behind the wheel thinking, I'm okay, I'll be okay. No, it's just plain selfishness. They only care about themselves.
Tom, thanks a lot for sharing the story again. Sorry for the loss in 74 for you and your family. Frank, are we hearing the voices? Obviously, the pain's still there for Tom. Are we hearing those voices enough?
No, absolutely not. People need to, first of all, MAD is always looking for folks to help out on the ground. There's a lot of things that can be done in Wisconsin. The lawmakers are not hearing it enough, and they need to hear it. The pain and the suffering and everything that needs to be done. Where MAD's at, and I think people want to see change. We're not trying to, we always get accused of acting emotionally. Well, we're trying to put forward data-driven approaches that have been studied, that are proven to reduce drunk driving deaths.
Tom, thanks again for the call. In our last minute or so, Tom, give us your top two or three things, or in budget season here in Wisconsin, your top goals for a state like Wisconsin when it comes to driving under the influence.
I'm Frank.
Yeah, Frank. But, I'm sorry, Frank.
I think, we're hopeful that in Wisconsin, sobriety checkpoints is not going to happen. 0.05, never going to happen. But we believe that there can be improvements made to the first offender drunk driving law, specifically boosting the use of interlocks. And there's different proposals out there that can do that, that I think would be legislatively palatable and can be done in a way that will help create a future of no more victims. So there's plenty of proposals out there. We just hope something happens.
We'll leave it there for now. Frank, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Frank Harris, Director of State Government Affairs with Mothers Against Drunk Driving. He was with us today to talk about the impact of drunk driving in Wisconsin and what works to reduce it, what they're hoping to see happen in state legislatures around the country, including here in Wisconsin. This is part of our ongoing series with the WPR News team called High Tolerance, looking at Wisconsin's complicated relationship with alcohol. You can find a lot more of our reporting, features, and stories over at WPR.org/alcohol. And if you have a story, if your life has been affected by a drunk driving crash, you can share that with us. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or if you have thoughts about the legislative priorities we've been talking about over the last half hour, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has worked on a lot of tough cases over the years. On this day in 1965, FBI analysts made a key finding in one of those difficult investigations. It all centered on one piece of controversial audio evidence. That's the Kingsmen and their cover of the song Louie Louie. Why was the FBI listening to it? Well, the lyrics of the verses of the song were hard to understand. And a lot of concerned citizens in the early 60s came to the conclusion that the poorly recorded and poorly enunciated vocals were actually profanities and obscenities. And that would have been a crime under the Transportation of Obscene Material law. As reported at History.com, enough citizens complained to the federal government that the FBI got involved. FBI investigators interviewed the songwriter and record label executives, and the lab played the song again and again at high speed, normal speed, and low speed. On May 17, 1965, FBI technicians reported that the lyrics were, quoting, unintelligible at any speed. No charges were filed, and Louie Louie became a mainstay of American three-chord rock and roll history. This is Central Time.